This is Unpaved's episode 2, and today's episode starts from the platform at Bamford Station. Bamford is just outside of Sheffield in the Hope Valley, and it's quite a quaint little station.
And absolutely freezing. The weather forecast hadn't looked so good for about a week out. I thought we were going to get hypothermia or something, because it was looking like -2 and torrential rain.
The drive over, there was a lot of snow when we were on Snake Pass, but then when we dropped into the valley, there was quite a lot of sunshine, wasn't there? And although it was kind of bitter on the platform, like, actually, I was a bit reassured that the bike ride wasn't going to be riding in a blizzard.
Do you know what Steph had said? That the Hope Valley is a bit of a microclimate?
So Steph is one of the guests that we've got in the programme today. Steph's from Pannier, which is a bike touring company that organised trips all over the UK and actually all over the world as well. We've got Steph on board because this episode is about route planning.
So we've got Luke and Christian coming from the other side of the peak. They've come over from Manchester, and those guys are responsible for the Second City Divide route,
which is almost entirely off-road route that you can ride between Glasgow and Manchester.
And I can say from first-hand experience that it's an absolute banger. They also went into business together this year and launched Outdoor Provisions nutrition brand, making bars with compostable wrappers and all sorts of other exciting things.
We've got local legend Duncan Philpott, mountain bike photographer and more recently gravel riding.
Really fascinating bloke. So that was, yeah, good little group of us, I think.
That was really nice to chat to them. And I liked the Outdoor Provisions. We were carrying a Bakewell pudding. They had Bakewell tart bars. So we felt very Peak District on brand.
I like how you're taking credit for that. Steph was carrying a Bakewell pudding.
Did I take credit for it?
Yeah, you said we.
I mean, you know, that's not taking credit for it, is it?
I think Steph deserves full credit. That was really nice.
He does deserve full credit. I also liked riding next to Steph because in his frame bag, I could hear the metal cups and his stove kind of clanking along as we were going.
And you know what? That is a very important thing to emphasise, inside his frame bag. No dangling on this trip. I think that's probably my favourite part of the whole episode, actually. But you'll get onto that later.
Yeah, we end on that bit of a
controversial issue.
Yeah, yeah.
Touchy subject.
For anyone that doesn't know, dangling is dangling a mug off of a bag somewhere on your bike, basically.
I don't think I've ever asked you. Are you dangle or anti-dangle?
Ooh, well, do you know what? This episode's definitely put me off.
Good.
I have dangled. On a practical level, it is just really handy because quite often you can't fit a big tube into your bag very easily. And I also ride with a Caradise bag, and it's got like little buckley straps, which are just perfect for putting through the handle of a mug. So it's kind of inviting you to do it. But the pockets on the side of it are also the exact size of most of those mugs. So you can kind of put them in and then just pack everything inside it, which is...
pair of pants or some socks or something.
Yeah, pair of pants in your mug is good if they're clean. So I'm kind of sitting on the fence with it a little bit.
I think we should do like a poll or something. See how many of our listeners are pro versus anti-dangle.
The dangle pole to rival doodle pole.
Yeah.
Great, it's let's like set it up.
Bikepacking's number one question. I mean, obviously, it's a really obvious question to answer.
Because
because I don't want to get the shits from... okay, sorry, no.
But why is it so obvious to be so anti-dangle?
Because you just get a filthy mug and then you got a drink out of it. Ugh, yeah. Just pack your bags better, really. It fits inside.
Right, anyway, let's get
we're
going.
We're getting a bit sidetracked.
So we'll let everyone introduce themselves. And then, you're going to hear us set off on the ride round Lady Bower. There's also Damflask Reservoir and Howden, I think it's the third one. And then we kind of loop back. And after the ride, you'll hear a sort of longer chat where we sit down in the pub.
Yeah, and don't forget that you can go and do this ride yourself as well. We're going to have all of the routes from every episode of Unpaved on our Komoot account. And if you haven't heard of Komoot before, it's a route planning and navigation app. So that ties in really nicely to this episode because we're talking about how you plan really great off-road routes. And that's just a really great tool for it, especially with the algorithms that mean that you can choose either mountain biking or gravel riding or road, depending on what kind of flavour of ride you're into.
So hopefully you'll come on this ride with us, and if you get inspired, then you can obviously download the route, but you can also have a little go at trying to see what it comes up with in your local area if you fancy going out on a ride after this. So let's get going.
Let's do it. Here comes the train.
I'm Luke, one of the founders of Second City Divide and more recently Outdoor Provisions from the Manchester side. And first time I've ever met Steph from Panya CC. I've been followed him for ages.
I'm Christian, so I'm the other half of Outdoor Provisions and Second City Divide as well. I also live over in Manchester with Luke, not in the same house. That would be pretty bad.
My name's Duncan Philpott.
I'm a photographer of most things outdoors. Kind of transition more into this style of cycling from the World Cup downhill cross-country race scene, which used to be where I started with my work.
I'm Steph, one half of Panier CC, bikepacking and adventure cycling tour company.
So what have you got planned for us today, Steph?
So we're in the Peak District, in the Dark Peak area. Quiet roads, gravel tracks, proper mountain bike territory if you head towards Hope in Hope Valley. We're going to do, basically heading on the Thornhill Trail out to the first of three reservoirs. So we'll do skirt around the Lady Bower, Howden and Derwent. They're kind of famous from early 1900s when they were built to provide loads of water for further south towards Nottingham. Super nice quiet road, and then the East Banks gravel tracks all the way around. And from there you can end up back in the top end of Bamford Village. There's a community pub there, so we're going to stop there.
And you say Peak rather than the Peaks, which was very early nipped in the bud in my first email to you. Why is that?
Only because I was calling it that, and then loads of people kept telling me it was the Peak.
The Peak.
Early on.
Dark Peak.
Early on, so I got it nipped in the bud. Yeah, because there aren't really many peaks. Mam Tor is probably the only typically peaky peak there is. Kinder's the high point, but it's kind of a plateau, so it's nice rolling. It, you know, nothing here is as epic as some of the other national parks, but you know, it's got a nice escape factor and it's stunning and high enough to get out and have an adventure on the bike.
Certainly testing on the legs all those hills though.
Yeah, definitely.
It's the original national park as well. It's the first to form. It's where they started with the mass trespass. First mass trespass was up onto Kinder to protest against land ownership and stuff. And then shortly after that, the government formed the national parks. The Peak was the first one, followed by the lakes and all the other ones. So it's like the OG of national parks.
And it's the most visited park by all accounts, just because of its central location to Leeds, Manchester, Sheffield, Nottingham, Derby. And it's kind of accessible from all over, which is makes it a cool point. And for us, we had the Sheffield and Manchester contingent, so it kind of made sense to meet on the famous slow train line between the two, halfway in the Hope Valley. So, yeah. Let's go.
You've been doing sort of in the lead up to starting Panier. What were you doing when you were Steph before you were Steph, one half of Panier?
So, grew up in Croydon and came to Sheffield to study architecture and worked as an architect for 5 or 6 years in London. Yeah, got into cycling from being in Sheffield in the Peak really while studying, playing a lot of rugby. And cycling was a new form of getting out and about and fitness. So a lot of road riding. Had like an entry-level giant road bike that I loved getting out. Used to do a round to Chatsworth and back, which was nice to do at the weekend. And then a long tour doing Land's End John O'Groats changed the way I thought about riding bikes. Three of us, me and two good mates, Luke and Danny, didn't really know what we were doing, kind of waterproofing stuff with bin bags on the back of our racks, sleeping in pub beer gardens in tents. Yeah, and we just lived the free life for 12 days, I think it took us.
So how did it change everything?
just saw the freedom and the leisure aspect of riding bikes as opposed to the kind of riding for fitness or whatnot on the road. We still weren't really riding anything unpaved, obviously, at that point. But yeah, it's that slow travel aspect that still is at the heart of what I kind of try and do today, whether, even when we're racing. There's always a slow element to it. And yeah, started blogging about our travels and taking people on trips from about 2010, 2011. And it's slowly developed into what it is today in 2020, and we've got a full calendar of trips and tours planned in for this year. So.
What I really like about the look of the trips, I've never been on one, is that they are something which you could book thinking, I want an adventure holiday, but it seems like it's as much about teaching skills and confidence so people can do it themselves.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case, whether intentional or not. Yeah, we get a whole range of folk on our trips. Last year was the first year we kind of ran quite a few trips and had a lot of people coming through, which is great. I mean, that's one of the main things I still enjoy what I'm doing, is meeting everyone, taking people and hosting people out in cool places. But yeah, they range from people who are super experienced bikepackers and just want to come along for the social or the group aspect, if they maybe don't know a lot of people who do the same stuff. People who ride out the puddles. Never done anything like it before. Maybe they're fell runners or outdoorsy people already. And looking at trying something new, or ride a lot of road and are interested in this new mass niche form of riding bikes, the whole gravel adventure side of things. So hopefully we're a bit of a gateway, and it's quite nice to hear back from people that have been on a trip maybe like a month or 3 months later, who maybe then gone and bought a bike and some bags and are going and doing stuff themselves. But what's really nice is that even if that is the case, they'll generally come back on another trip, you know?
Yeah.
There's arguments that, you know, when we're promoting what we're doing to the general public, there's always people who say, oh, you know, they're public, why would you not just go and do it yourself? And I'm a huge advocate for both. Like, that's how I got into it, and I still go off and do it. Anyone who emails us about a trip and says, what route's that, can I have it? I'll happily help them out and point them where we go. And actually, it's quite a nice collaborative process where they're like, oh yeah, that looks great. I can see where you're going on that map or that mapping app. And they'll effectively plot it themselves with my help. So if people know where the nearest towns are from plotting it themselves or whatnot, then that's great.
That edge is, that's
our
right now.
So on the right is Bamford Edge, that one.
Right.
And it's the grit stone that climbers around the world all come to visit. It's weird, you'll be at one of the big alpine peaks in a hut. Someone will be like, oh yeah. Off to climb the north face of it. They'll be like, oh yeah, I know Stanage. I go there a lot, and it's like, Stanage is tiny, but I love it.
Morning.
Well, the remains of the village that they built to build the dam.
Here?
Yeah. This was a bustling village at one point.
Wow. You just take it for granted when you have running water in a city. You don't think about where that's come from and what impact that's had on people.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the same with that. Desert Wales stuff, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, Eland Valley.
Birmingham's water, isn't it? Out that way.
Yeah. Because you were talking about how you planned routes before. If your one bit of route planning or trip generation is basically stay away from roads, it leads to the best form of route generation, because you're trying to connect places
with tracks or paths or loads of unpaved stuff, and that's what leads to the interesting trips and escape routes, basically.
When you first started doing it, how did you start that process?
Well, when I was first doing this sort of stuff, I was a map geek anyway. It was an OS map thing. Google Maps, Komoot, all these apps and GPS things weren't a thing, especially in my world. Pink, 1 to 50,000 map. You'd basically pick out the yellow roads and dotted tracks. Early on, I wasn't doing everything off-road. So the off-road stuff's probably only been 3 or 4 years. But yeah, it was a case of digging out all the yellow roads. And then where you can't get to where you want to go, trying to link up the dotted tracks and bridleways, you can pretty much guarantee that will lead to a nice route, I'd say. And then check the contours, obviously.
I always forget to check the contours.
It's one of those things that you learn when you go, don't you? Yeah. You make a mistake once and then you know what you're looking out for next time.
I think that's one of the things on route planning, like you've got to be prepared to have a bit of a shit ride or something go wrong and not be right, because it's constant refinement as well if you've got to do that. And you will, yeah, you'll have bad times. Like, you might have seen the picture of Luke's just done a Second City Defied Edinburgh link up, basically, and he was out in the Pentlands doing that the other day, and he's like walking through knee-high cow shit. Like, that's the reality of route fettling.
I think the biggest experience factor for route planning is, for me, is now turned into not just route generation, but working out what a group of unknown people might be able to get round, or making stuff accessible for people that you might not know, because anyone can sort of book on our trips. We, Dave and I, ask a few questions and get a bit of information to make sure everything's right. But they are designed as accessible adventures, so we always know people can get round them. They might be challenging for some, super challenging for others, or kind of nice riding for others, but pit stops along the way, and it's kind of knitting together a route that has stops around lunch, like snack stops or sheltered spots where people can regroup. So it's not just the route anymore. It's a lot about resupply, connecting stuff, and yeah, and if stuff goes wrong, for example, us getting out of it, that's another big factor. So, you know, if you come on anything sort of pannier or organised by me recently, it's has got all those factors at play. It's not just a simple A to B.
And hopefully those are things that you'll never actually have to see or understand, but it's really important to have those emergency exit routes.
And I think that's what it's become now. Was thinking about those other things as well. I think that really, you learn about a place so well just from plotting your own route. And we're saying, seeing contours, and someone will be like, "Oh, that bit you said there, that looks awful." And you're like, "Yeah, but yeah, it is." But,
but I sent you up there anyway.
But the accommodation's just over the hill, or there's a village there or a pub. And someone will say, "That was a really good one the other week about the Lake District." And the guy was like, "Oh, down from Thirlmere to Grasmere, that's the main road," and which is what you basically say, avoid main roads. So he spotted that, and I was like, "No, it's fine, it's all downhill, it's really wide, it's fine." So, you know, that's that collaborative process of route planning. So on a map, that actually looks a bit naff, but it's fine in real life.
When did you first get the idea to start trying to connect up Glasgow and Manchester?
The UK's two most glamorous cities. It probably was born out of sort of the trip we did that gave us the idea was, well, the two trips were Badger Divide, so doing Inverness to Glasgow, which we actually didn't make it the whole way out, we had to bail at the end. That and Torino Nice Rally, which were incredible trips, but just took quite a lot of logistics, especially the Torino Nice one. It was worth it because you get to ride through the Alps, but you had like a day and a half or even 2 days of travel either side, or the way we did it, you did anyway. But we liked the idea of riding city to city on a big A to B trip. That was kind of super exciting and linking together lots of nice parts. We kind of had an inkling of areas that we liked and a couple of like belting stretches that we'd seen. So like Salterfell Road, which is this sort of 12k section in Lancashire, so we knew that wanted to be in it, and we knew that there was the Cam High Road bit in Yorkshire, straight out of Ribblehead, that we wanted to link, and then these bits in the Borders that I'd ridden. So they kind of, they already were in place, and then from looking at maps after that, we went and found even better or as good places in between, but not first try. We had to go and did a lot of recceing, a lot in winter and stuff, to kind of test and actually rule out a lot of stuff. It's like we got into riding these kind of, I don't want to keep calling them gravel bikes or adventure bikes, but the kind of riding whereby you were actively looking to avoid roads, or certainly busy roads, because there's plenty of good B roads on this. Some of the best bits are some of these like hidden B roads. But it was to really hit the kind of wild places and use the kind of high volume tyres and the fact that you had your gear with you to be a bit further away from civilization and stuff, which you, in the Scottish bit you definitely are. There's quite big stretches between resupply. If we went anywhere that we thought was great, we put that down as like a point of interest, because it's useful to know what time it opens and is it seasonal and what kind of stuff you can rely on getting.
How long did it take to do it in a wanna?
It was 6 hard days, like probably harder than we wanted to. But like I say, it's got a little bit more refined since then. So I still think 6 days is a good time to do it in. Steve Bates, the Paralympian, absolutely battered it in about 2.5 days, but he also did like a 38-hour riding day to do that. So depends what time of year you'd go and what kind of how you want to stay. Because you could do the whole of Second City staying in B&Bs if you wanted to. Like, it goes through enough places. Well, you might struggle in Scotland, but if you're going kind of fairly light and fast but have enough stuff to sleep in, I think that 4, 5, 6 day mark is perfect for Second City. And like I say, it champions UK exploration, UK riding, UK bike packing, which is so diverse. Like, you go through so many different landscapes, areas, accents in 600k. It's so diverse. You've got like, you get hints of Geordie when you're over at Kielder. You've got Manx, you've got thick Lancastrian, bit of Cumbrian through the Pennines, then into like Scottish Borders and hard Glaswegian at the other end of it. And there's loads of like a big mix of food as well. There's just so much more than just going and riding your bike. This is the things that it can open you up to. A bit of, because you go over Hadrian's Walls, there's like a massive bit of British history and culture there. You could stop and spend a day there if you wanted to. There's that new Sill Hostel on Hadrian's Wall. It's like one of the newest YHAs, which is a great stop-off place. I think there's about 6 YHAs on the route, which is another great accommodation option. You're supposed to ride at Glasgow to Manchester, but then Catherine's done it the other way and taken a load of nice photos. Whoever wants to ride at Manchester to Glasgow now.
Is that a bit annoying?
Not really. just though, mainly because we like the name Glasman. We started talking about the Glasman as a bit of a mythical beast that hunts dangle mugs, and loads of people have taken that on now. So I've heard all sorts of stories about people's encounters with the Glasman. Now to the point where I'm not even sure if he is real or not.
Does he hide under bridges like a troll?
Yeah, that is one story I've heard, yeah. Loves mucky, misty Pennine weather. Yeah, extremely dangerous, do not approach. Maybe he's misunderstood, actually, I don't know.
I really enjoyed the coffee stop halfway round, which Steph laid on for us in true pannier touring fashion. I don't think I've ever been so grateful. Oh, this makes me sound like a total snob. I don't think I've ever been so grateful for a hot mug of instant coffee. it was just the way he had, you know, his bike there with a full frame bag, and then all of a sudden out of nowhere, like, this whole Bakewell pudding comes out and it's still warm from the bakery down his road in the morning, and it was, yeah, absolutely delicious. That was so good because it was about freezing point, but with the wind chill it was sort of -2, -3. And I don't remember the last time I did a whole ride with my insulated puffer jacket on and a waterproof. That was really bloody cold.
Just come down to this little stone bridge. Just a little bit up from...
That's
Lady Bower Reservoir on the Derwent. And as you can probably hear, Steph is cooking us up a brew, which is much needed because it's a little bit freezing on the extremities. We've been sort of tracking around the edge of the reservoir as it goes into the valleys. And on one side, it will be lovely and beautiful in the sun because it's not actually that cold on that side. But then you go on to the other side of the reservoir valley, and it's, yeah, there's still snow all over the place and freezing, biting winds. So I think we're all ready for a nice warm drink. And Steph's actually got a Bakewell pudding for us, which is a very authentic Peak District fare, which looks, I was going to say it looks really appetising, but the way he's peeling the foil off.
Looks a bit like a quiche with almonds on it at the moment.
Yeah. Do you often have coffee outside midway through your rides? Or are we the exception?
Basically always got coffee making apparatus on me at all time.
Along with your survival bag and your tools. And
yeah,
your
first aid kit, coffee making, pen.
Ooh, why the pen?
Just maybe sketching stuff, I don't know. It's a bit too fast paced this ride though, isn't it?
So is this a Bakewell tart?
No, this is a Bakewell pudding, importantly.
Yeah.
Just softer and more almondy without the icing.
Somebody stick a hand in.
So that... Here, Ray, go for it, Ray.
Mm. Oh my god!
Is it still sort of warm?
That's great.
Mm.
How would you describe the flavour and the texture of a Bakewell pudding? Not tart.
Mm. I think with the Bakewell tart, with the icing layer and the cherry, you get the almond flavour, and often it's got that line of sort of cherry jam almost as well. But the almond flavour doesn't have the same like sort of richness as we've got going on in here, and also the tart is a little bit more cakey, whereas that's a bit more like a treacle tart.
Incredibly sweet, but also moist.
Yeah.
Yet the pastry is still dry and crunchy.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not sure how they do that. It's, really it's very good. Who wants a hand warmer? You look chilly.
Thank you. not going to be polite about that one. Thanks.
How do you distill a Bakewell tart into a bar?
Eat a lot of Bakewell tarts, first of all. All our bar flavours, there's like probably two key elements in the original foods. They try and pick out, so we've got a lot of almonds in there, some really nice like freeze-dried sour cherries, but there's a debate on whether it should be cherry or raspberry for Bakewell as well. So
Is the original cherry or
it's raspberry? I think the original is it.
We've got a couple of visitors, got two ducks literally like a meter away, just looking quite eager.
Come for Bakewell crumbs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're not the first people here, are we?
It's a popular stop-off spot for when all the geese and stuff migrate through. And you just turn up one day and it's hundreds everywhere.
I thought you were going to say a popular picnic spot, and this is why they've come to get all the crumbs. Ducky duckies! I'll give this one.
We stopped at what people would know as the Slippery Stones Bridge. It's kind of a nice plunge pool on the Derwent, Peaty Water plunge pool, and it's kind of the dead end on a gravel bike, the end of the two reservoirs, and then we loop all the way back round the eastern bank, back towards Bamford, and that's where the gravel, so we've just done nice quiet roads, bit of gravel, and then now it's gravel all the way back. Feels kind of wild for where it is, considering where it is, but yeah, it's nice. It kind of is a dead end and whatnot for us, so yeah, time to head back.
Right, so it's gravel now. There's a couple of gates to stop us,
but.
So like all good rides, we're finishing in the pub. We're in the Angler's Rest, which is quite appropriate because we've got Duncan with us, who's a very, very keen fisherman, if that's the term, angler, and just enjoying a few pints whilst we wait for our fish finger butties. So we're at the end of the ride today, but I'd really be interested to know, Steph, how you go about planning a ride like this one that we've done today and what sort of things you take into account when planning that.
I think a big part of riding bikes and the slow travel vibe that we try and recreate is also the time off the bike. So today it was a case of thinking about a couple of scenic-y, nice, sheltered, picturesque places to stop and brew up, get people warm again, places where there's water. So technically next to rivers, that's also a pretty good thing that I look out for if we're planning a lunch stop or something, even if it's just for like washing stuff at the end, but yeah, having water for hot drinks, getting people warm again. And that was kind of half sorry, there's a piano recital happening. Is there actually?
Like just there, it's a group.
Yeah,
I think it's the local choir having their practice.
Oh man, yeah, they do requests. Sometimes there's natural points in a ride when you'll stop, and today was one of them. Everyone was pretty cold actually. I borrowed Catherine's gloves, I thought I'd be able to get away with it. But everyone was cold, and it was the right point to stop and enjoy it a bit.
I would never normally think about a water point either, because I'm not normally carrying cooking equipment unless I'm touring. So, yeah, that's a really nice thing to bear in mind.
Yeah, the off-the-bike stuff for me is just almost just as important as the riding. So,
I think yeah, your trips are possibly just the best experience. I think that's the best way of summarising it. Like, really good routes and all that, but I've come away with some of my favourite camp food that I've ever tried, like some of the curries and things like that. They're just absolute winners, and there's always loads of little memorable additions sort of outside of just the cycling. And I always notice if you're somewhere else and you're getting, you know, you seem always very keen to take on the hospitality of guys from other sorts of, be it hiking, trekking, you know, mountaineering side of things, and always picking up on the individual tips and tricks, like their traits and all yeah, that, and incorporating that then into the pannier side of things. So you have like nice aspects that are fairly unique.
Lifting yeah, it from others, I think, is the
not lifting,
the technical term.
Adapting and adopting.
But I guess it's those things as well that really help when you're taking a group out of people that might not all know each other. The friendships probably really start to gel at those moments.
Yeah, and people enjoy getting stuck in. You know, we were talking earlier about that educational aspect and learning a couple of little things that they might then take on their next trip, whether it's a way to make a hot drink or using a different stove or working out which stove is more packable than the others, where they can carry all their stuff. Like today, I just lobbed everything in a frame bag quickly, but when you've got more stuff, that process of packing and working out where the best place for stuff is takes a lot of getting used to, as everyone around the table knows. Even the term bike packing is not even that well recognised. So when you're talking about giving someone at the start of a trip, if someone's hired bags, you might leave a pile of seat packs, frame bags and bar bags, and you've kind of got to expect them to have never fitted them to a bike, so there'll be that process of learning how to use the new type of bag, how to fit it, how to pack it, and avoiding bag sag, which is the
how do you word. Avoid bag sag?
Avoiding bag sag is experience based.
Structural umbrellas.
There's nothing sadder than bag sag. Witness firsthand.
Yeah.
So you were saying about bike packing being a relatively undefined term. What does it mean to you?
If someone who didn't know what bike packing was, didn't know what this mass niche of gravel riding was, didn't know what adventure cycling was, you could say it's backpacking with a bike. I think that's the best way of describing it for me, because it kind of denotes traveling. That's what it's about. It's always about that kind of overnight aspect, and carrying everything that you need to have a good time out on the bike. And that's what differs for everyone, really. For me, I like to have a certain set of equipment on me. For others, they'll go and do the same tour I'm doing, but with literally nothing. So I think that's how it varies. It's the comfort levels and what you get out of it that define what type of bike packer you are. So yeah, I'd definitely take the heavier, more comfort level type. But a couple of events last year, like Silk Road, it was a case of really stripping back what I needed and redefining what bike packing was for me. Yeah, testing a few ideas out, I'm quite happy to now revert back to the leisure side of bike packing. Now we've finished that. Kind of need the same amount of stuff whether you're going out overnight like you guys did in the cold of Oxford. As you do, you could have that same amount of kit on your bike and go away for much longer. Definitely, if you're looking for the more unpaved stuff, the new form of setup is the way to go, really. And it's about adjusting to how you can carry what you need to carry and what you shouldn't carry, because that experience then tells you, oh, I didn't use that, I don't need that. Yeah, you work out what you need, and you don't need three merino base layers for a 2-day trip, let alone a week.
So what would be your go-to pieces of kit that you never go on tour or bike pack without?
I've decided I'm not a bivy person. So I would take a small tent. There's loads of ways I've now got used to splitting it up, which will work. So rather than looking at a tent as a big single item, splitting that up onto fork bags, poles can go in the frame bag and whatnot. So I'm always a tent person. Cookware and stuff to make drinks and food, that's also a big important aspect. Working out what stoves and cookware works for you. Sporks are massively important, mugs. And then off the bike, down jacket's a critical bit of kit. And gloves, as we worked out today. So looking at it from a riding perspective and an off-bike perspective, off the bike I'd always have down jacket, gloves, like some sort of polar techie legging to wear off the bike to keep you warm, warm socks, sleeping bag or quilt, and a pillow. A pillow is the newest, best thing ever. It's before
your age, definitely.
No, it's one of those experiencing again, because there's only so much sleep you can get when you've got your head against a wet pair of shoes or inflated dry bag, which is a good tip for anyone. If you do need a pillow, blowing into a dry bag and then sealing up is quite a nice pillow. But an actual outdoor inflatable pillow has totally changed my sleep when I'm outdoor. Yeah, that makes a big difference because you're fresh, ready for the next day. Snack-wise, definitely some sort of tonics material. and outdoor provisions. But food and drink supplies for the amount of time we do. Wherever we're going, if we're going to Scotland or wherever, always try and research a local one-pot meal to try and cook when we're there. So that always forms the bones of some sort of recipe or ingredients list. Whether it's Cullen skink or a Bosnian stew, that kind of informs what we'll cook. And then, yeah, sketchbook and pens, always like making notes and sketching, and sometimes you need to not rely on a phone for that sort of thing.
So you talked a little bit there about camping out. When you're camping, do you find it's best to plan where you're going to be and when, or do you think that flexibility is a bit more important?
That would massively depend on what sort of trip it was. If we're, for example, we're going to the Picos in Spain in February, and that's like semi-planned as to where we're going to be, not to the exact spot. I'm going to turn that back around. Oh. What would you look for?
I guess this is something that I've learned through, as you say, sort of getting it wrong, yeah. Or being very sneaky. Like when we're in Oxford, camping under the trees, and in the morning you could see a really hard frost in the open area. Looking at the cloud cover overnight, will tell you how warm it's going to be, or, you know, BBC weather app. Somewhere sheltered, somewhere that's not too close to the water if you're in high summer and there's midges and things like that.
As you said, I would look for somewhere semi-sheltered, by a river, but not right next to it. It's quite nice having some water.
What's the worst place that you've camped?
100%. I know exactly where this is without even thinking about it. It was, we were on a moor. We did a film trip in a few years ago in north of Scotland, which we called Beulah, which is up to Cape Wrath. And I was already nervous because I was with Will, who you met on your last podcast, from Brother Jordan and Luke. And I could just tell Luke and Jordan were flagging a bit. It was quite late and the weather was all right at this point, but we just headed up into this dead-end valley with no shelter whatsoever. Jordan fell in the river. Luke was like ready to go and find the nearest train station. And we ended up like camping basically on a floating bog thing. And it stormed and it was horrendous. I think that's another point of these. If you're taking, or if you're, there's a mental pressure of being responsible, I guess, if you're someone who's planned a route. And that was a night when I was like, oh, this is bad. This is never going to happen again. We tried to cook some sausages. It was just like nothing was working out. We went, everyone just tried to go to sleep at about 8 o'clock in a bog, and it was just miserable.
You've done a lot of touring, not only in the UK, but all over Europe as well, both on your own or with Pannier. How does that compare? And do you think the UK is more or less accessible than those places for, say, introduction to bikepacking?
We're far denser here in the UK population-wise, so it's almost easier to go do your first foray of a local loop, because everything's quite widely documented, because there's a lot of voices on the same stuff. There's always amenities nearby, as you said, but then you go into Europe and the possibilities are almost endless. Mm. You know, there's massive tracts of land through alpine regions, through mountains, which are probably quite imposing for your first time if you're not an experienced sort of person or aware of like hut networks or how all that sort of stuff works. And you know, your resupply could actually be a full day's ride away, which makes it quite tricky. And we found out the hard way on one of our trips when we left the national park, trying to find somewhere to sleep. We just come out of a huge national park and it was straight into competitive agricultural land, because you know, the land is suddenly available for that kind of use, and that's all it was. And there was like one wooded copse, and like we could see it in the distance. So we made our way towards that, and it was nightfall as we got there. This was winter in Spain, and turned out there was someone hunting, and they let us know with a lovely warning shot, and like we'd interrupted someone's hunt. They were definitely disgruntled and not law abiding in the way that they were going about letting us know. So we kind of ran off with tails between our legs, all white as a sheet, and ended up, there was nothing around, and snuck into a cattle shed on one of the farms to sleep the night. And then you don't sleep properly because you just think that the same disgruntled farmer that's shot at you is just going to turn up any second now. And you know, you don't sleep all night, but you know, it was warm and dry, and it was Christmas Eve in a cattle shed, so no immaculate conceptions, thankfully, as well.
I guess it depends where you go. If you want something really wild and remote, then you can get pretty lost in Scotland very easily.
I think the unpaved thing is key for this, really finding wilderness, or what feels like wilderness and escape, especially in the UK. There aren't many places left that you don't see anyone or really feel remote or lost. And that's why we did focus on the Desert of Wales trip, because, I mean, that in terms of accessibility to get to start and finish points, that area of the Elan Valley and Mid Wales is really special for that. Because, after what I've just said, but even a lot of the roads are not visited. And it really feels like the middle of nowhere. And that's, I think that's what people are seeking. It's just,
and it's, a lot still, to it's still a human influence because somebody's put it there, but it feels a lot less 21st century than a tarmac road, I guess.
Yeah, and that's what, if we're going back to the Europe thing, that's the interesting and the hard bit about it, because all of that amazing route infrastructure, a lot of which we've ridden, is basically their military, and in Scotland, they're all military influence roads and networks. So good has come of bad almost, and you know, they're things like our bunker tour in the south of France with Max Leonard really opened my eyes to that, and how important that military road building process has been for opening up and unlocking the mountains for cyclists. Mountain biking is slightly different because you're open to all that.
We're thankful for donkeys.
Yeah.
In mountain biking, you can tell what's an old donkey trail when you're in the Alps, because like, you just know as soon as it gets steep, it switches back at a radius of... Well, like the hiking trails, they switch back too tight to be very flowy, but if it was an old donkey track for lugging stuff, the switchback would be just open enough to hold plenty of speed. And they're really common in certain tracks of the Alps, and you can be riding along and then you know, or you can see it's dipping away from you, and then the corners almost follow like a predefined format, and you're like, oh, it's probably an old donkey track. It's amazing how the old... That's like Ash Smith, who organises Trans-Provence, just has archaic maps of old land uses, old... Be like, he's the Sospel Valley where he used to live, and you know, they'll be like, oh, there used to be a terrace here 400 years ago, which means there's a path to the terrace, and they go and reopen the path because it's still there, cut through the rock and everything like that. And you know, get enough wheels across it and a new trail is opened. Like you say, with the gravel bike, and it's mostly moving vehicles to get something of that width around, which was pretty much war on that. And I think events like Torino Nice have, you know, a lot of the Italian French sort of front to thank for all of their route.
And how important do you think an appreciation for the landscape that you're in, whether it's where these trails have originated from, or you know, when the bothies were built and why, do you think that's important to people that are passing through them?
I mean, I find it interesting. Just mentioned that bunker trip that Max helped organise, and that was fascinating. The process of building these huge bunker infrastructures in the mountains is just incredible. And so then riding the routes that they use to build them and transport personnel and everything up and down them and resupply. It's not just the building of them, it's the logistics of how they were used as well back in the day. Like that, I find that really interesting. Yeah, shuttling up food supplies and crepes and all, whatever they used to take up. Baguette.
Escargot,
yeah.
I just find it so interesting, and it's such a contrast to the cycling mania that we've had in the UK, that's, you know, road cycling, go as fast as you can, what's FTP, and it's just such a contrast. It's about like exploring where you are, the history, like you said, the wildlife, and I think the more that you understand about the impact that you're having and what you're taking, the more you respect it and actually change the way you behave.
I think it takes a trip, whether you're riding, hiking, whatever you're doing, spending time outdoors and surviving is a huge learning curve on that front. I mean, even the big thing on Silk Road was 2 sheets a day. Like rations, like, it sounds silly, but that's how much you needed. So that's how much you stocked up. No, different days were different. But it's a thing where that's what you learn, that is what the minimum you need to get by, and what you actually need versus what's just nice to have.
So we've spoken a little bit about your tours with Pannier, but I think it's, from an outsider's perspective, or even having been on one of your tours, it's so much more than just bikepacking tours. Can you tell us a little bit about the philosophy behind Pannier and where it's come from and what you really think it is today?
We've coined this 15 kilometres an hour club. And the feedback so far has been positive, in that people understand that evokes a sort of slow travel appreciation of riding bikes. In reality, the trips probably even end up being less than that, probably like 5 to 10.
I remember the morning when we got off the train to snow in Italy, and we didn't expect it to be snowing, and we were really cold, and we were absolutely tanning it. And our average speed was 15 kph, and we felt like we were tanning it. And we were like, this is probably not the best 15 kph club ever, because it was just like deep snow. And we were like working.
It's so subjective, because I remember when I came on Route Beer Ramble last March, and I was amazed because we got to the end of the day, and the first day was pretty big. And 15 kph, and I was like, well, I didn't feel like we'd been riding slow, but obviously it's mixed surface, and then you're like stopping and chatting and like having a little snack and things, so it didn't feel overly fast or overly slow. It was just that sort of sweet spot touring pace. So yeah, I think you nailed it.
It is a sweet spot, and some trips, whatever trip you're doing, you pretty much end up around that. But it's, if you're talking about planning routes or planning trips for the first time, it's probably a good benchmark to go off in terms of what you're capable of distance wise. So base your trips on doing 15 kilometres an hour, if you like stopping and riding at a normal speed anyway. We've talked a bit about the off the bike stuff as well as on the bike. It's, if I see bikes as much more of a tool for experience, I think that probably shows in the Panier stuff. So it's accessible, challenging adventure.
I think from a personal perspective, we chatted a couple of years ago when I was really struggling to find like-minded people to go on these sorts of rides with. And we were talking, you know, should we make some sort of forum or some way of getting, I don't know, like young professional or non-professional, whoever it is. I was single at the time and was like looking for just mates. I didn't have anyone really in my area that wanted to do these sorts of things. One of the things that struck me most about Root Beer Ramble was just bringing in these collection of people from all over that area or even the UK and beyond, who are like-minded to get together. And then it's not just what happens on that trip, it's what goes beyond. And I've kept in touch and actually really good mates with a lot of people from that tour. I think you're helping to facilitate that, which is really incredible. It's more than just going on a tour, it's building this off-road community.
Yeah, that's our aim. And I think that's the difference between the kind of 3-4 day trips that might not appeal to some people that come on the weekend stuff. And it's really one of the main reasons why we try and do the overnight short weekend trips, because A, that's what a lot of people have time for, and they're a lot more accessible. So you can get, we talked a lot about wild places and going in search of escape, but the Root Beer Ramble last year really hit home to us that actually just a really nice city to city trip with a group of people's fun, and people want to do it. And this year in March, there'll hopefully be 60-70 people doing it this year, and that'll hopefully roll on and get more people knowing about each other and knowing about unpaved bike packing. That's what keeps us going, is meeting people, and then people who may have hired a bike and some bags to start with on one of our trips, and then they'll message in like 2 months and they'll have a bike and some bags and going and doing their own stuff. That's really cool. That's cool to see. That's what we want to see. And then they will still come on other trips that we do, because it is about that group and social aspect and bringing people together, whether it's 15 people on one of our normal trips or 50 people on a more relaxed weekend experience. So yeah.
Well, I've got an important question. Are you a dangler or not? Do you dangle, Mug?
I did. I've stopped
yes.
Dangling.
What stopped you dangling?
It's really hard to say in public, this. No, Dave actually got really ill on Silk Road. We think it was from a dangled mug. So, yeah.
Well, I'm going to use that as ammunition. So watch out. Every time I
watch
see somebody
out,
dangling
kids.
Now, my watch friend out, was on kids. Silk Road.
No, we think it was, and yeah. there is a good argument for stuff. Like, I started dangling. People will always say, like, you've just got stuff all over your bike, and that's literally just because I can't fit it in the bags I've got. So there's an argument for that. And mugs are annoying things to pack in a seat pack or whatever. So there is rationale for it, but I have changed my tune. There was no dangling today.
No, I noticed. Confessions of the dangler.
So that's a wrap on episode 2. Been riding around the Hope Valley with Steph, Dunk, Luke and Christian, even in the snow.
Yeah, it was beautiful. It was really cold, and that kind of made it just even nicer to get to the Angler's Rest. If you want to do the route yourself, then you can download it from our Komoot account.
There's a couple of choices for the route from this one. I've got the one that Steph planned, but then I thought I'd also upload one that I did whilst I was up there that week with Alpkit from their Hathersage store, which is just up the road. And that was a more technical route, I'd say. So a bit of hiker bike and some pretty gnarly descending for a gravel route. So you've got the option of both. The first one with Steph was fairly mellow and much more sort of entry level. And then you've got the option of a more tricky route. So you can pick and choose, really.
Yeah. If you want to take our route as well, but you feel like you want to do an extra sort of 10-20k, then of course you can do that in Komoot, and you can just add on a little sections around there. So do have a little play with it if you want to extend it.
And in addition to the routes in the Peak District, obviously you can check out Second City Divide route on Komoot. So this is another one of the features where you can literally pick up pre-made routes via the collections. So you can browse those, and it's actually one of my freelance day jobs, if you like.
Side hustles.
Side hustle, whatever you want to call it, is that I work with Komoot to upload gravel and mountain biking, long distance trails all over the UK. So it's not just the route, it's really handy information about how to get there, what kind of bike you'll need, what the terrain's like, whether there's hotels or guest houses, B&Bs, camping spots, all the sort of local highlights and things. Yeah, you can tell I do a lot of this. So we'll put the link to the Second City Divide one in there. And if you haven't used Komoot before and you'd like to give it a go, then they've given you the option to have a free region bundle. So we'll put the instructions for that in the show notes. It's super easy. You just have to make an account and enter the voucher code UNPAVED, all in capitals. And another thing to mention whilst we're talking about free stuff is that we've got a giveaway. So you'll have heard on episode 1 about Brother Cycles from Will with Brother in the Wild, which is their annual bikepacking weekend sort of mini festival that you've done several times that I'm doing for the first time this year. So Komoot have given us 2 tickets to give away. All you have to do to enter is to sign up to our newsletter, and we're going to pick at random in early March. All the details are on our website for that one.
So I hope you've enjoyed listening. Next time,
we're in Oxfordshire with the Racing Collective and also chatting to Lachlan Morton over WhatsApp, I think it was, in the end.
Yeah.
From Australia.
That podcast is all about when you take off-road riding to extremes. So the focus of it is GB Duro, which is essentially Land's End to John O'Groats off-road. You might have heard about that. If you did, you'll know that Lachlan, who rides for Rafa EF as a sort of road cyclist, but has also been doing lots of off-road stuff, did it super fast. So we're talking a bit about that, but also about the planning of that ride, the idea behind it, and the experiences of Tom Pro Bear. You'll understand that when you hear it. Tom Pro Bear riding it, Philippa Batty riding it, and Mars Rezzo riding it as well in that podcast.
Yeah, Philippa and Miles organising it as well, which is quite something. Yeah, it's a real corker. It wasn't just a ride, it was a bike packing overnighter. So a little bivvy in the frost as well, which, yeah, it was probably the coldest night I've had this year. But really incredible, incredible experience. So we're looking forward to that one.
At some point, we should compare bivvy versus hammock with you with you being a hammock advocate. We haven't really done sleeping in detail yet, so we will get to that at some point. But you've been listening for long enough to this episode. So
until next time. Ta-da!